home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the BBC News on 5 Live, I'm Giuliano Casaday. 6 o'clock. The death of the leader of Hezbollah has been described as a historic turning point by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Hassan Nasrallah was killed in an Israeli airstrike on his group's headquarters in the Lebanese capital of Beirut. Mr. Netanyahu said the killing was evidence his country was winning its fight against its enemies.
We settled the score with the one responsible for the murder of countless Israelis and many citizens of other countries, including hundreds of Americans and dozens of French. Nasrallah's elimination is an essential condition to achieve the goals we have set.
The MP Rosie Duffield has told the BBC that Keir Starmer's team cares more about greed and power than about making a difference. She's resigned from the Labour Party and will now sit as an independent MP.
We all had our faith in Keir Starmer and a Labour government, and I feel that voters and activists and MPs are being completely laughed at and completely taken for granted.
She's criticised the Prime Minister for accepting tens of thousands of pounds worth of gifts from donors. Downing Street has yet to respond. Three people have been charged with murdering a man who was stabbed in Norwich last week. The body of 19-year-old Calvin Taylor was found in a flat last Saturday. The suspects are due to appear before magistrates tomorrow. The Conservatives' annual party conference starts in Birmingham today, where the focus will be on the party leadership contest. The four candidates will use the conference to argue their case before two more are voted out of the race. SpaceX has launched its mission to bring back two astronauts stranded on the International Space Station since June. The Dragon capsule, which has two empty seats for Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams, lifted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. And Oasis are due to reveal more details tomorrow after a cryptic message appeared on social media. The band posted photos of billboards featuring Noel and Liam with the headline saying, "Be careful what you wish for." Those are the news headlines. James Gregg has your sport now.
Jules, thank you very much. A very good morning to you. Football first in the Premier League. Liverpool went top of the league table after a 2-1 win away at Wolves yesterday. Mohamed Salah's penalty sealed all 3 points for Arne Slot's side, who now have won 5 of their opening 6 league fixtures in today's Premier League action. Ipswich Town are at home to Aston Villa. That's at 2. And in the late kickoff here on 5 Live at 4:30, Manchester United take on Tottenham at Old Trafford. In the Scottish Premiership, champion Celtic wrapped up a 9th straight win in all competitions in serious style against St Johnstone, 6-0, the final scoreline. Rangers play Hibs at midday. In cricket, Lancashire have been relegated to Division 2 of cricket's county championship, whilst Yorkshire have been promoted. And in boxing, Terry Harper reignited her career by outpointing fellow Briton Rhiannon Dixon in Sheffield to become a 3-weight world champion. More sport in a bit, but let's get into it then. It's 5 Live Science.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, welcome to 5 Live Science. I'm Chris Smith from The Naked Scientists. And coming up, signs that fruity vapes paralyse the immune system in the lungs. The world's oldest cheese, but why was nearly 4,000-year-old dairy product smeared all over an ancient Chinese mummy? And why it might be a giant leap to suggest we're getting an extra moon, even though we are, although just for a while. Plus, a bit later on...
There is very, very good evidence now that boosting the immune system by releasing the brakes on T-cells can improve outcomes for many different tumour types.
We find out how vaccines are revolutionising the prevention and treatment of cancer.
The Naked Scientists on 5 Live.
A new study has found that berry-flavoured vapes can paralyse the action of immune cells that normally patrol the lungs and prevent infection. The study which has just been published in the journal PNAS and was conducted on experimental lab mice, is the work of Erica Pence at the University of Saskatchewan and Ajita Thanabalasuria from McGill University. How, I asked Ajita, did they end up looking into this in the first place?
It really hit us in 2019, where there was this outbreak of e-cigarette-related lung injury in teenagers. So one is the type of e-cigarette products that kids were drawn to and that was marketed for them. It was really like the fruity flavors and the candy flavors. And we thought, what specifically do these flavors do to our immune system?
What happened to those kids? What did they present with?
They presented with lung injury. So essentially they would go into the hospital and they looked like they had a flu infection. But when they did a test, they came out negative for the influenza virus. And a large portion of these individuals who got very sick, or actually passed away were in the U.S. And at the time, there was a lot of studies done in the U.S. and they kind of chalked it down to this one part of e-cigarettes called vitamin E acetate that was in their e-cigarette product. And since then, they've banned vitamin E acetate from e-cigarettes and they've had fewer of these lung injury in young kids. But the thing that was interesting is that vitamin E acetate was never allowed in e-cigarette products in Canada. And we also had those lung injury cases. And again, they were smaller proportion, but it still made us think there was something else to this story that we weren't catching yet.
So how did you pursue it?
My lab really focuses on something called intravital microscopy. We're actually able to image immune cells moving through the lungs of a live animal. And then Erica came in and she sort of suggested that we look at specific flavors that were really, you know, that were really popular with kids. And so we focused on this like berry mix flavor. And we compared that to an unflavored e-cigarette vape. And we looked to see how these mice responded to exposure to this e-cigarette products. And our outcome was this imaging technique where we were able to actually track these cells called macrophages, which are white blood cells in your airways, and we're able to see how they move around in the presence and absence of this flavored e-cigarette product.
All I can see in my mind's eye at the moment is a mouse vaping. How do you do that?
So it's not exactly the same as humans. So humans can actually physically, you know, take in a puff from an e-cigarette device, whereas with mice, it's more of a passive treatment. So basically, we put our animals into these little cages, and then we expose them to an e-cigarette that's puffed through a machine. And it just sort of blows it onto the animals, and they inhale it passively. So it's more of like a secondhand smoke. And so what we did with the animals was that we exposed them to the e-cigarettes for 1 hour a day, every day, for 3 to 10 days. And we just really looked to see if there were subtle changes in our immune system.
So when you say you can see the cells, what do you mean you can actually see the cells moving through blood vessels and tissues and then track what goes where?
Exactly. So our lungs have these spaces called alveolar spaces, and they're essentially like these grape-like structures that are strung together, and that's where our gas exchange occurs. And in those alveolar spaces, we have these really important immune cells called alveolar macrophages. And what's interesting is that there are more alveolar spaces than alveolar macrophages, and these macrophages are tasked with patrolling around each alveolar space and checking if there's anything that you inhale that's bad for you. The air we breathe is not sterile. It's filled with particulates, it's filled with bacteria, and usually they are cleared by either in our nose, the mucus in our upper respiratory tract, but sometimes things do get down into our alveoli, and these macrophages gobble them up. And their ability to do that relies on their ability to move and their ability to move around that alveolar space and between. And so we can actually visualize in a healthy mouse these alveolar macrophages moving around in alveolar space and in between alveolar spaces.
Are you looking from outside the mouse then?
So it's a surgery that we put a little window into the pleural surface of the lung. So we're not putting anything into the airways. We're actually looking from the outside in.
And what happens then when you compare animals that get this vape exposure with presumably equivalent mice that don't? How do they differ? What changes?
Alveolar macrophages stop moving when we expose them to specifically the berry vape. And really what we found was that the major movement that they were unable to do is to move from one alveolar space into the other when we take in berry vape.
Do you think this is going to have functional consequences? In other words, were those mice to then be exposed to potentially infecting agents or other kinds of nasties from the environment that those macrophages would help to clear, the fact they're paralysed or stuck in situ, would that, you think, lead to these mice being much more susceptible to lung problems?
Oh, yeah. So that's what we found. We gave them some bacteria and we found that the alveolar macrophages weren't able to get to bacteria that landed in an alveolar space that was next door that didn't have a macrophage in it. So this inability to squeeze to the next alveolar space inhibited them from clearing that bacteria. And this resulted in more bacteria growing inside that berry mouse and the mouse not doing as well.
What do you think the mechanism of this is? What's the chemical that's doing it? And can you recreate the effect by just providing the chemical in the vape in isolation? Can you paralyze macrophages that way to prove that it must be the chemical in the vape? Or is there several things happening which culminates in these macrophages not doing their job properly?
You know, Chris, science is never black and white. And so that's what we figured out. So we actually did all these fancy techniques and we took our berry e-cigarette vape and we figured out all the different chemicals in it. And we isolated those chemicals and then we gave animals individual chemicals and it didn't have the same effect as the combination that blocked the alveolar macrophage function. So it really had to be all of these complex chemicals going in at the same time. And individually, it didn't have an effect. And we actually tested one other flavor because I didn't want to go down the garden path of testing every single flavor out there, but we kind of stuck to like the chemical composition of different flavors. And we tested something that was very different from berry, which was menthol, and it didn't inhibit alveolar macrophage behavior.
What are the implications then, in your view, of what you found?
I think that we've seen, and in many places, including the province that I'm in right now in Canada, that flavors are probably not a good idea to have in e-cigarette products. And we need to be careful about the types of flavors that we're including in these products, and they can have detrimental effects. And I think that's really the take-home message, especially some of these vaping products are marketed for kids, like the way they're sold, the type of containers they're sold in. It's very colorful and it's really attractive to children. And this can be a really bad thing for our future. So I think that's really the take-home message.
That was Ajita Thanabalasuria. She's at McGill University in Canada. To China now, and the discovery of the world's oldest cheese. Scientists believe that a carefully preserved substance dating back some 3,600 years that they found smeared on the heads and necks of mummies in the Tarim Basin was a dairy product. But it wasn't until recent advances in DNA analysis that they were able to say for sure that what they were looking at was a kefir cheese. And sequencing the bacterial genes in the kefir grains, which fermented the ancient milk into cheese, has revealed how they've evolved to become better cheese makers over the last few millennia. We asked the University of Cambridge archaeologist Emma Pomeroy, who's an expert on our ancient ancestors, to have a look at the study for us. And, as it turned out, the very mummies that are mentioned in the study are what inspired her to follow her chosen career in the first place.
The mummies described in this study, they come from what's now northwest China. It's called the Tarim Basin. It's part of the Taklamakan Desert. And they're actually quite famous mummies. They're naturally mummified bodies from the Bronze Age. So we're talking about 3,500, 4,000 years ago. And they're a population that I heard about, you know, when I was quite young. I remember watching a documentary about them and being really excited just by the richness of the culture. So because of the way the bodies were treated once they died, they were put in kind of coffins, which were then sealed over with cow hides. This has helped preserve not only the bodies, but also all the clothes they're wearing. So they've got these amazing kind of tall felt hats and feathers and little booties and things like that. They're really fantastic. Interesting too, because as a people, they look different to what was expected for that part of China. So a number of the individuals have quite sort of European looking features, perhaps even blonde hair, and were a bit taller than some of the other surrounding populations. So from that point of view, they've been a bit of a mystery. And genetic evidence has actually suggested now that they descend. So they're kind of a remnant of a very ancient kind of Pleistocene, so Ice Age population from North Eurasia, who actually have very few descendants now. But even at that time, they were kind of a pocket left over of people descended from those ancient populations who were different from the other ones surrounding them.
They didn't migrate in later and establish a pocket in the surrounding population. They were there first and got surrounded by what we would call more modern Chinese populations then. So they were there first.
That seems a very plausible scenario. It seems like the populations that were originally in that very broad area of ancient North Eurasia were ancestral to these populations.
So these dairy products that they were involved with, why did they end up on the mummies?
That's a really good question, and I think we don't know is the answer. So it's really interesting, there's sort of chunks of this kefir cheese kind of around the neck and the head area. Why it would be there is really hard to answer. And there's a bit of a standing joke in archaeology that if we can't sort of say what something is for, we just say, oh, well, that's ritual. And possibly that is. I mean, sometimes when there isn't a practical explanation for something, symbolic activity, so a meaningful activity that's not necessarily got a functional purpose to it, but has some meaning for the population, perhaps in the way they culturally believe you should treat the dead, that's where the behaviour comes from. It's not to say, though, that everyday things that we do don't have a ritual element as well. I mean, you think about sort of how we eat, you know, we use certain implements, we lay the table in a certain way. And that all is, if you like, is a kind of ritual in itself. So things can be functional and ritual at the same time. But in cases where we can't see something clearly functional, it suggests that it's something cultural and symbolic.
And how have the team that have been studying these mummies, how have they pursued this investigation of the cheese?
What they've done is they've taken small samples of the cheese itself, and they've been able to sequence DNA from the bacteria and from the fungi, and actually even from the animals who produce the milk that the cheese was made out of, to be able to tell exactly what it is. And from that, they can tell that it is kefir cheese. So when you make kefir, the particular kinds of bacteria are involved that are different from making other kinds of yogurt or dairy products. And so they can say that this was kefir that's then been made into cheese.
And does this therefore give us insights into their husbandry techniques, the sorts of animals they had, in what sorts of numbers, how genetically diverse even their herds were? What can we learn from that DNA evidence?
It helps to support some of the other evidence that we have about their lifestyle. And we can see, for example, that they're using both goat's milk and cow's milk to produce the kefir, but usually not mixing it together, which is really interesting. You make it from one or the other. We can then see that they are herding and keeping these animals to be able to have access to that milk. And that fits quite well with the other evidence we have. So things like the animal bones that have been found, the cow hides that have been used to produce the burials, some of the clothing and things like that. So what we've built up is a picture of these as sort of nomadic people who are herding extensively. We can also say a little bit about where those herds originated from. So where did those animals originally come from? And we can say that that's likely to have been in the Caucasus, essentially.
That was Emma Pomeroy at the University of Cambridge, and that study detailing the world's oldest cheese specimens has just been published in the journal Cell. You're on 5 Live Science with me, Chris Smith, and still to come, why the Earth is getting a temporary extra moon and the vaccines which are revolutionising cancer treatments. But first, we saw a story about a naked clam, and we thought it would be very remiss of us here at The Naked Scientists not to cover it. The researchers have been developing a way to grow these bizarre organisms, which can apparently eat their way through an oak beam and sink a ship in under 9 months, as a possible source of food. They've also been using artificial intelligence to analyse social media to explore the appetite of would-be consumers towards eating these bivalves. Supposedly, they're delicious, and most people decide they like them. To find out more, I went to meet Cambridge University's David Willer.
Something sunk Columbus's ships when he was sailing around the Caribbean in the 1600s. And that something is actually a type of clam, which instead of having a shell, eats and burrows into wood. These things can reach up to 2 metres in length. They're huge. We dubbed this the naked clam, also pterodinids. That's the kind of scientific name.
When you say that naked, that no shell whatsoever, so are they a clam that's lost their shell at some point then, or did they just never have one? Are they the sort of clam equivalent of a slug versus a snail?
Take Nearly Headless Nick from Harry Potter. They've nearly lost their shell. But what's actually happened is the shells evolved into two big boring drills, which allow them to drill into the wood and actually inspire the drilling machines for the Channel Tunnel.
Well, where did they actually come from then? Because obviously ships are a fairly recent phenomenon. Did the wood that fell in the sea then, is that where they would have evolved this behaviour?
Naked clams naturally would consume wood degrading in the sea. They're often found in mangroves, actually, where they'll eat mangrove wood. So if you go out to the Philippines or Thailand, you will find people who've consumed them for thousands of years and harvested them from the mangroves.
Wow. And what was the question you wanted to know about them, apart from the fact that they look like they sank Columbus's ships?
Well, the key thing is that recently we designed the world's first lab-scale naked clam aquaculture system. But any new food solution is useless if no one's actually going to eat the animals. So we wanted to understand, are people going to eat a naked clam and will they enjoy the taste of it?
First of all, tell me, what does that aquaculture system involve? Are you basically just chucking bits of wood in a swimming pool and they grow? Is that the idea?
Our concept is actually something like a shipping container when we scale it up, where you put wood in, you farm the naked clams, and you get a nutrient-packed protein source coming out the other end.
So you just eat the clam, that's the idea, or do you turn them into something else?
You can eat the clam, or you could process it into fish fingers or fish cakes.
And what does it taste like?
They taste like oysters, but like a whiskey, tastes a bit like the wood you've held it in. The flavour of a naked clam is influenced by the wood you grow it in. So something grown in oak is different to something grown in teak or something grown in pine.
Now, two of those woods are hard and valuable. Pine's a bit cheaper. Is this something we could do sustainably?
Our concept aims to use waste wood from the forestry industry, so the kind of chippings off the forest floor, and we're working with pine at the moment.
Okay, so how does this actually work then? I know you said you've got a shipping container, but what's the throughput? How long do they take to rear? Is this actually practical?
Currently, we're running a lot of scale-up work in our labs. We're targeting a six-month production cycle, so 6 months from your juvenile to a larger individual, around 30 centimetres in length.
That's quite fast growth.
It is fast growth. They are the world's fastest-growing bivalves. There is a lack of data on that. We're trying to get some really good numbers on that data.
And are they good for you? As in, do they contain various nutrients that if you eat this, you're not having to eat salmon and so on because you want some oily fish and so on? Can they substitute for other rarer things that we're currently decimating the oceans to get?
They are nutrient rich. We've done the world's first nutrition analysis on them. They've got more B12 than mussels, which are already renowned as a B12 source. They're high in protein. And because they feed on algae too, you can fortify them with extra omega-3 by providing them algae. But it only works if people eat them.
And what does the research suggest? And how did you do that to find out?
We decided to leverage AI. It's a hot topic, but actually it can be really useful. And what we did is we analysed all the videos and comments and likes across the big social media platforms. And what we found was really interesting. Whilst before trying naked clams, it was about 50-50. Half people thought they liked them, half people thought they wouldn't like them. Once people had tried them, about 84% of people liked naked clams. And that's really key because that tells us that if you can get people to overcome that initial hurdle of trying a new sustainable food, it can go a long way to driving change.
Were these at raw? I mean, how do you prepare them? And do you think you're looking at a subgroup of people who are ambitious and willing to try something a bit novel? And your average person, if you went to an average person in the street with a plate of these things, they would just say no thanks.
So there were a variety of recipes ranging from, yes, raw, to naked clams battered a bit like calamari, to in kind of marinated dishes and stews and curries. So a big variety of dishes which do suit a variety of tastes. One thing worth adding in is that we did get the Financial Times actually to pull together a set of recipes, and we got one of them cooked out in the Philippines by my student's mum, who cooks them regularly for dinner. That was fantastic. You know, tasted lovely.
That was David Willer. Now, you may have read or heard in the wider media that the Earth has allegedly acquired a new moon. Well, ish. We've certainly picked up a new satellite of sorts, but it's a bit of a giant leap to say this lump of rock is going to give our mainstream moon a run for its money anytime soon. Nevertheless, here's Cambridge University space scientist and public astronomer Matt Bothwell to help clear things up for us.
So the object is the very imaginatively named 2024 PT5 in the long tradition of fantastic, memorable astronomy names. It's a near-Earth orbit asteroid, so it's a piece of rock, something about 10 metres wide, which is orbiting the Sun. And on the 29th of September, it's going to get close enough to Earth that it's coming into our gravitational sphere of influence and is going to start sort of orbiting the Earth. And so this is where it hit the news, right? We're going to have something orbiting the Earth. It's going to be a new mini moon, but it is a little bit more subtle than that. So really, to be counted as a temporary satellite, you have to do one orbit around your planet, right? At least go once around. And this thing is not going to make it all the way around. It's going to do a sort of a horseshoe-shaped slingshot around the Earth before heading off into deeper space. So we are going to get a temporary flyby companion, but it's a bit of a stretch to call it a temporary moon.
How far away will it pass?
So it's going to be about five times further away than the regular moon. So the regular moon is at 300,000 kilometres. This thing's closest approach is going to be about 1.5 million kilometres. So it's not nearby by any stretch of the imagination.
Visible or not?
Absolutely not, unless you have a sort of multi-million pound telescope, I think. Even a very, very big backyard telescope won't be able to pick this thing up. So unless you have access to a professional astronomy telescope, I think your chances are slim.
How did it get detected then? If it's quite hard to spot, it's quite small. How did scientists spot it in the first place?
Scientists have programs to detect near-Earth asteroids because there's always a risk that they might be dangerous. So we have catalogues of hundreds of thousands of things going all around our neck of the woods in the solar system. And so this was just picked up as part of our regular searching of the sky for anything that might come near us and be potentially hazardous.
No risk that that might happen?
No risk whatsoever, no. This thing is going to do a little loop around us at this very safe distance of 1.5 million kilometres and then carry on its merry way.
And if it were on a collision course with the Earth, would it be consequential, something that's that size, about 10 metres across, or is that too small really even to notice? Would it even make it to the ground?
Yeah, this is far too small to be a problem, even if it did hit us. In order to be like at risk to something like a city, you need to be a couple of hundred metres across. I think something like this would cause a spectacular fireball and probably not make it all the way to the ground. So even if it hit us, we'd be safe, but it's not anyway. So there you go.
Can we get any clues from its path and trajectory where it might have come from? Where do scientists think its origin was?
It's a difficult one to say definitively, but I think there's a strong clue that it might be a piece of the moon, what scientists call lunar ejecta. When we look at its path around the Earth, doing its like near-Earth object thing, it's moving as if it was once ejected from the surface of the moon. So this could well be the remnants of a meteor strike that hit the moon billions of years ago, threw up shards of rock, and this thing has been orbiting around for billions and billions of years.
Has this sort of thing happened before, or is it a one-off?
It has. It happened semi-regularly. There was something in 2022 and in 2020 that was very similar to this. The last time we actually got a proper temporary moon was in 2006, when a near-Earth object came and spent about a year orbiting around the Earth before zipping off. So yeah, every few years something like this does happen.
Can that happen then? How can something temporarily orbit and then disappear again? Is it on a sort of expanding orbit or something, so it's sort of captured for a while and then eventually gets lost? How can that happen?
Yeah, I think captured for a while and then eventually gets lost is a good way of putting it. Orbits have to be very, very exact to be what we call stable, so that they can exist for, you know, thousands or millions or billions of years in the case of our solar system. You have to have a very, very exactly precisely correct amount of energy to be in a stable orbit, ever so slightly either side of this exactly like bullseye amount of energy, and you can be temporarily captured, but then either fly off into space or fall down onto Earth.
University of Cambridge's Matt Bothwell, thanks to him. Well, now it's time for the news and sport, but after that, we're going to be examining how vaccines are revolutionising how we prevent and treat cancer.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the BBC News on 5 Live, I'm Giuliano Cazaday. The death of the leader of Hezbollah has been described as a historic turning point by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Hassan Nasrallah was killed in an Israeli airstrike on his group's headquarters in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. The MP, Rosie Duffield, has told the BBC that Keir Starmer's team cares more about greed and power than about making a difference. She's resigned from the Labour Party and will now sit as an independent MP. Three people have been charged with murdering a man who was stabbed in Norwich last week. The body of Calvin Taylor, who was 19, was found in a flat last Saturday. And Oasis are due to reveal more details tomorrow after a cryptic message appeared on social media. The band posted photos of billboards featuring Noel and Liam with the headline, "Be careful what you wish for." Sport now with James Gregg.
Good morning again. Well, worth recapping the day's action from the Premier League yesterday. England international Cole Palmer scored four times in the first half for Chelsea's 4-2 win over Brighton. It's the first time that's ever happened in the Premier League era and the first time a player has scored four in a game since 2019. However, the Blues player himself was disappointed not to have scored more.
Should have had five or six. Yeah, when I missed the first chance, I was upset, but I thought the way they played and how high the line was, we would get more chances, and yeah, we got a lot more chances, and I just took the...
Liverpool now sit top of the table by a single point from Manchester City and Arsenal. Arne Slot's side made it five wins out of six with a hard-fought 2-1 win at Wolves, and the boss Arne Slot was relieved to have picked up the 3 points.
I don't think it was our best game. The first 15 to 20 minutes we had... We had really difficult, very good game plan of Gary O'Neill. And then afterwards, I think we took more and more control, which led also to our first goal.
Arsenal scored twice in stoppage time to earn a dramatic victory over Leicester at the Emirates. A Wilfred Ndidi own goal in the 94th minute, and then a bit of a lucky Kai Havertz strike in the 9th minute of added time denied the Foxes, who were within reach of an unlikely point after coming back from two goals down in the second half. 4-2 it finished, and Mikel Arteta agreed that his side got away with one.
Now we are really happy, but obviously we could have been in a very different position because of the two goals that we conceded. But certainly with the performance, I think we have to be super happy.
Anthony Gordon's second half penalty in the early game earned Newcastle a point as Manchester City were held to a draw at St James's. There were wins yesterday for Everton and Fulham over Palace and Nottingham Forest respectively, whilst Brentford and Fulham also played out a 1-1 draw. In the Scottish Premiership, champion Celtic wrapped up a 9th straight win in all competitions in style against St Johnston. 6-0 it finished yesterday. In Rugby Union's Premiership, reigning champions Northampton put their opening day defeat behind them with a deserved 30-24 win over Exeter. Elsewhere, Saracens beat Sale by 45-26. Afterwards, Mark McCall was asked about maybe losing one of his coaches, Phil Morrow, to the England coaching setup.
I can understand why he's in demand. He's an outstanding in his field. And I know there's talks going on when you're talking about someone's credibility or to do it. You know, Phil's everyone knows what he's like. And hopefully small-mindedness doesn't get in the way of a good decision.
One match today as Leicester Tigers take on Bath at Welford Road. In cricket, Lancashire have been relegated to Division 2 of the County Championship, whilst Yorkshire were promoted yesterday, and Terry Harper reignited her boxing career by outpointing the fellow Briton Rhiannon Dixon in Sheffield to become a three-weight world champion. More sports in breakfast on 5 Live from 7. Now, though, back to 5 Live Science.
BBC Radio 5 Live, the home of Formula 1.
Oscar Piastri wins the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. He takes his second Formula 1 win in the last five races.
Exciting times in F1.
This afternoon from 1.
Marina Bay Street Circuit.
Singapore.
Can Red Bull turn around their fortunes on a track that they haven't got good history at? Or are McLaren in a league of their own now?
Listen to live coverage of every lap
on 5 Sports Extra and BBC Sounds.
Welcome back to 5 Live Science with me, Chris Smith, from The Naked Scientists.
The Naked Scientists on 5 Live.
Recently, doctors announced some extremely encouraging news about a jab for people with advanced forms of several types of malignancy, including melanoma, lung cancer and other solid organ tumours. The vaccine is called mRNA-4359 and it's been developed by the pharmaceutical company Moderna of COVID vaccine fame. The trials have been conducted here in the UK, and we'll hear from the man running the study a bit later on. But first, we're going to take a look at how cancer actually develops, how it's traditionally been treated, and how these new cancer vaccines look set to become a revolutionary tool in the fight against the disease. Here's Charlie Swanton. He's Cancer Research UK's chief clinician, a principal group leader at the Francis Crick Institute, and a thoracic oncologist at University College London Hospital.
Cancer refers to an uncontrolled proliferation of cells that ultimately derive from a single cell of clonal origin that, due to their uncontrolled proliferation, invade the tissues around them and ultimately invade and spread across the body.
Roughly what proportion of the population will have a run-in with cancer. So what would be my, if I'm an average person, which I hope I am, what would be my lifetime risk of this happening to me?
The Cancer Research UK estimates over a lifetime, one's risk of cancer is somewhere between 1 in 3 and 1 in 2 individuals will develop cancer.
It's quite high, isn't it?
It is high. And it is a disease of ageing for the most part.
Why does it happen, though? Why is it that when I'm young, you don't seem to see very many people who have a malignancy, but as we get older, it tends to occur more commonly?
There are many theories. The first is that as we age, we accumulate more mutations in our cells. But what has become apparent over the last 5 or 6 years is that actually our normal cells in our body, our normal tissues, are a patchwork of mutant clones. And actually, whilst mutations may be necessary for tumour initiation, they're not sufficient. And so other aspects are required. And that probably relates to chronic inflammation that's required to initiate the first tumour cell with mutations, and possibly local tissue disorder, so disruption of normal tissue architecture that can occur with ageing.
So it's a range of things that have got to go wrong, the odds of which increase as we get older. So it's almost like aligning all the holes in the Swiss cheese to get an aligned hole that enables cancer to escape and become a problem.
That's exactly right, Chris, yes.
So what sorts of other things are controlling cancers normally then that mean that a young person doesn't have a tumour?
I mean, first of all, a young person has many fewer mutations than somebody like me in his mid-50s. Younger individuals just simply have fewer mutations in their normal cells. They're less exposed to the chronic inflammatory stimuli that I referred to, and their tissues are more ordered and more structured in a normal manner. But in addition, the body's own immune system plays an important role in keeping malignant clones at bay. And indeed, it's been postulated that tumours are initiating much of the time in elderly individuals and are being controlled by the body's own immune system and being prevented from initiating and evolving.
That's fascinating. So basically, many of us could have cancer at any one moment, but then the immune system stamps on it.
The answer to that question is hard to prove. Where we have evidence for it is from, we can look at sort of the archaeology of cancers that have evolved in patients and find very strong evidence for what's called immune editing. That is a footprint or a fossil record, if you like, of prior immune activity against the tumour. That is, it has essentially annihilated malignant subclones with what we call immunogenic potential. That is, the potential to alert themselves to the immune system. So we have evidence from looking at tumours that they have been predated upon, if you like, by a functioning immune system in the past.
Can I kind of paraphrase that then and say, basically, the body's trying to produce cancers from time to time because it develops changes in the DNA, mutations that make a tumour try to appear. The immune system responds and stamps it out, and you can see in the genetic record of the immune system or in the tumour itself the fact that has happened, but then eventually there's some kind of breakthrough that enables the tumour to occur. So is that because there's a loophole in our immune system and cancers are just basically probing our immunity until they find the chink in our armour?
It's a very good question. The answer to your question is that there are ways that the cancer cell evolves to evade alerting the immune system to its presence. And that can occur from ways in which the tumour can mutate DNA. It can mutate specific genes that are required to be recognised by the immune system, such that the cancer begins to evolve and develop below the radar, so to speak.
I suppose on the basis of what you've just told me, there is a precedent for expecting the immune system to be able to control cancer. We can see that it has done that in our own bodies in the past. Therefore, it's a question of when we have manifest malignancy. It's a question of making it work again, but this time work against that particular tumour. It's a bit like saying we know fusion can work because the sun's doing it, but we've got to get it to work on Earth. We've got to get it to work in the body against a cancer that has broken through.
Except that there is one caveat, which is we've already proven this works. So there is very, very good evidence now that boosting the immune system by releasing the brakes on T cells can improve outcomes for many different tumour types, both in terms of progression-free survival, overall survival, and even cures in the context of, for instance, solid tumours like advanced melanoma.
Talk us through how this actually works then. So what is the approach to trying to get the immune system to stop ignoring something that it had previously overlooked?
The way in which this works is that there's a subgroup of cells in the immune system called T cells. And these T cells have evolved over billions of years of evolution to essentially recognize non-self. But what we discussed in the last few minutes is that tumours also develop mutations and can appear to the immune system as non-self. But the tumours also, in their evolution, adapt and suppress T-cell activation. And what we've learned through some seminal work from Jim Allison and Honju, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine for this discovery, is that there are specific breaks on T-cells that are activated by the cancer cells that one can intervene on and block. And by doing so, you can release T-cell activity to attract them to tumours and recognise tumours and essentially annihilate them.
It's amazing the strides that science is making now, isn't it? That was Charlie Swanton at Cancer Research UK and the Francis Crick Institute. Now, the vaccines that Charlie was just discussing are chiefly intended to program our immune systems to attack a cancer that has already established itself. But there's one other anti-cancer vaccine that's been incredibly successful to the extent that it has nearly wiped out a formerly common disease in a whole generation of young people. It's the cervical cancer vaccine, which works not by targeting the cancer itself, but by preventing infection with the human papillomavirus, HPV, that causes the majority of cervical cancers to form. It's one of the biggest success stories in vaccine and cancer medicine that the world has seen. And almost 20 years ago to the day, before it was widely known about, one of the scientists who helped to make this vaccine a reality appeared on this programme to explain what would, in the years ahead, be rolled out and how it was going to work. Well, I'm very pleased to say now, Emeritus Professor of Pathology at Cambridge University, Margaret Stanley, is back with a recap on how the vaccine she helped to make works, how effective it's turned out to be, and why the human papillomavirus causes cancer in the first place.
It's because the virus makes different proteins, and two of these proteins actually can control cells dividing, and they can grow too much and they don't age. So it sticks the cell in its early juvenile state. And then there are accidents in the DNA, and bits of the virus get incorporated into the cellular DNA. They then control what the cell does, and that's the start.
Why are some of these viruses better at doing that and causing cancer than others? Because it's a big family of viruses, the papillomaviruses, and some are linked to this specifically. How is that achieved?
You call the viruses a family. They are. And like all families, they have white sheep and black sheep. And the black sheep are those that encode proteins that have this capacity to deregulate the cell. Now, these proteins are essential for the virus to make its virus DNA. And if they're made at the wrong time, that's when things happen in the cell. And it's only a few of these, of the black sheep viruses, that have these proteins. So it's specific to a group of viruses, even though it's a huge family.
And before the vaccines came along, what fraction of the population, if I picked a person at random from the population, what fraction would be carrying or infected by or have had a run-in with some of these viruses capable of causing things like cervical cancer?
Well, actually, 80%. You know, 80% of us either will have had one of these viruses, are going to get one of these viruses, or have one at the time. But most of us get rid of them. We have great immune systems, and the immune system gets rid of the virus. But some of us are unlucky. We're unlucky in our genes. We're unlucky in when we get the virus. We're unlucky in the age at which we get it. And that's when you get a group of things that really increase your risk. You're not necessarily going to happen, but you've got a big risk of it happening.
And how has the vaccine made a difference to that process?
It prevents the virus infecting, because the virus has to stick to the outside of the target cell and get inside to start its business. Now, the vaccine causes antibodies, and they bind to the surface of the virus and prevent it actually entering the cell. So they prevent infection. It's what's called a sterilizing immunity. And because you've prevented infection, you ain't got no virus there. So the sequence of events I've described doesn't happen.
And if one looks at what has happened in the years since we introduced the vaccine in a number of countries, what difference has that made to cervical cancer rates?
In the UK, we vaccinate school kids. I think it's year 7, year 8. Before COVID, we were getting 80 to 90% coverage. After COVID, it dropped, but it's starting to come back and everybody's working hard. So if you get that high coverage, then I can tell you the number of precancers caused by these viruses has virtually disappeared. And in women under 30, invasive cervix cancer has virtually disappeared. Now, it hasn't disappeared in the older women because they haven't been vaccinated. But the women under 30 have been vaccinated. If you've been vaccinated, you will not get the cancers caused by these viruses.
That's quite a turnaround, isn't it? Because I remember when I went to medical school, learning about cervical cancer, and more than 1,000 women a year in the UK alone were losing their lives to cervical cancer. And you're saying now that if we follow the cohort of people who are about 30 and below, that number will effectively be zero.
Yeah, it will. And in the UK, we've actually controlled cervix cancer very well. Our screening programme, despite all the things shouted about it, works well, but you have to come and participate in it for it to work. So before the vaccine, we had something like 3,000 to 4,000 cases of cervix cancer a year, and about 1,000 women died. Now, with the vaccine, we have something like 200 cases of cervix cancer, and the mortality has fallen equivalently.
Will the viruses disappear in the population effectively then eventually?
That's the idea. Providing we immunise enough people. The name of the game is vaccine coverage. You've got to be in it to win it. You've got to have your vaccine because then you're protected. And if there's hardly any virus, you can't infect anybody. The virus has nowhere to go. It has to move to another person to make more viruses. If that other person is vaccinated, you can't infect them.
It's a tremendous story, isn't it? Margaret Stanley there from the University of Cambridge. Still to come, can vaccines help to protect people with inborn preponderances to developing certain cancers? But first, we're going to examine messenger RNA or mRNA cancer vaccines. These can help the immune system detect and destroy cancer cells. They work by introducing short pieces of genetic material, mRNA, into the body. This is picked up by immune cells and then translated to produce antigens very similar to those displayed on cancers. This, in turn, triggers an immune response against that target. And it's also how the COVID-19 mRNA vaccines work. Debashis Sarkar at King's College London has been conducting clinical trials for patients with lung cancer, melanoma and other solid organ tumours. And he's been telling me how these new mRNA vaccines work in that context.
mRNA, it's like a instruction manual or recipe, and it tells your cells how to make a specific protein. So for a cancer vaccine, the mRNA is the recipe for making a tiny part of that cancer cell, what we call the cancer antigen. So when a doctor gives a cancer mRNA vaccine, it basically delivers that mRNA or that recipe into some of your cells, and those cells can read the recipe and make that specific cancer antigen. Once that is made, that is shown to your immune system, just like a wanted poster of the cancer cell. And now that your immune system has seen the abnormal antigen, it learns how to recognize it, and your immune system can then go around your body looking for cells that have that same antigen, which are actually cancer cells, and use the immune system to better recognize those cancer cells to try and attack and destroy them.
How do you pick your target? When you've got a cancer in front of you in a patient, how do you say, well, that's the bit of the cancer I'm going to persuade the immune system to go after?
The first is what we call a personalised vaccine, where one of the things that we can do is to do what's called gene sequencing to try and understand what are the abnormal mutations that a cancer cell is producing, and then to produce a specific personalised vaccine individual to that patient. That's one approach, and certainly there are a number of these mRNA cancer vaccines which have that particular approach. There are other cancer vaccines which look at more what we call off-the-shelf vaccines, which look at common, what we call antigens, which are occur across a whole range of different cancers, and using that RNA vaccine technology to target those specific antigens.
And do you cross-check to make sure that they're unique to the cancer, these antigens, so you don't then provoke the immune system to go running after your own tissue and effectively cause autoimmune disease, which could otherwise happen.
Yeah. So I think obviously part of this is for, you know, for these types of vaccines to train the immune system to recognize these antigens as the bad guy. You know, one of the theoretical kind of advantages of this type of technology is that it should be very specific for the cancer cells and not target your body's normal cells. And so the safety of these types of vaccines should be very good, because unlike things like chemotherapy, which are also attacking your body's normal cells, those should be relatively spared.
You've been running some trials against a range of different cancers, melanoma, kind of skin cancer, lung cancers and things. You've just been presenting the results of those trials. What have you been showing?
The trial that I'm currently involved with is a very early stage trial. So it's what we call a phase one trial of a new mRNA-based cancer vaccine. And this, as I've explained, is, you know, the principle behind it is to try and help the body's immune system target and attack cancer cells. And it actually is designed to target two specific proteins or antigens, as we've been describing, which can sometimes help the tumor to escape the immune system. So in the trial that I've just presented recently, we've tested this vaccine in patients for the first time. Now, because it's a phase one clinical trial, the main aim of this particular trial is really to test how safe and tolerable the drug is and work out what dose of the vaccine we should be giving. So in this particular study, what I've reported is 19 patients with a whole range of different types of cancers who had often received multiple types of previous treatment, including multiple lots of chemotherapies. And this particular vaccine is given as an injection into the muscle every 3 weeks. And what we looked at was really to see how safe the vaccine was, how well tolerated it was, and also whether it was able really to generate that immune response that we wanted to see, really to be able to take the drug into further development. So the findings that I presented were really to show that the vaccine was well tolerated with no serious side effects, which is kind of what we would expect from a mRNA COVID type vaccine, and that we demonstrated that the drug can activate the immune system in many patients in the way that we would want. And in some of the patients that we treated, we were able to show that for a period of time, you know, the cancer didn't continue to grow in the way that it had been prior to the study. So very preliminary results, but exciting. And we're now testing this particular drug in more patients, and in particular for patients with melanoma and lung cancers, really to try and see genuinely whether it's effective and can be potentially used as a treatment in the future.
Have you gone in and taken pieces of the tumours out in these patients to see if you're now seeing an intensification of the immune response, which if the vaccine is provoking the immune system to attack better, perhaps you'd expect to see?
We've been able to elicit that immune response that we wanted to see in terms of activating those specific immune cells, and also, you know, that impact on what we call the microenvironment. So the ability to activate important immune cells against the cancer, but also to downregulate or to reduce the activity of cells that sometimes suppress the immune system. So I think those are important findings that show the validity of this approach.
Debashis Sarkar there. We're going to conclude today's programme by examining the next generation of cancer vaccines now. Scientists from the University of Oxford are hoping to develop a vaccine for people with a genetic disease called Lynch syndrome. Affected patients have an increased risk of developing cancer in a number of different organs. The project is called LynchVax, and it's been funded by Cancer Research UK. Here's David Church, who's an oncologist at the University of Oxford, who leads the project.
Lynch syndrome is a genetic condition, and it's the commonest cause of genetic cancer, hereditary cancer, that's cancer that runs in families, in the UK and globally. It's caused by a faulty copy of a gene. So these are a combination of genes that are responsible for ensuring that when our DNA is copied before our cells divide, that copying is accurate. And what happens is that we're born with two copies of each of these genes, and people with Lynch syndrome are born with one faulty copy of those genes. And that means that during their lives, if they have a defect in the backup copy, their cells lose the ability to copy their DNA accurately. And as a consequence of that, there are errors, and we call them mutations, and then collectively, cumulatively, over multiple cell divisions, those errors can affect genes which are critical for growth of cells or death of cells. and that can cause cancer.
And who gets this, as in age-wise, and how would they know?
The increased cancer risk is from a young age. Young people with bowel cancer, we find they have Lynch syndrome. And the critical thing with Lynch syndrome is that we only know about a small fraction of people that actually have the condition. So there's a large initiative to correct that.
You're trying to treat it in an innovative way. Can you just compare what we used to do for it with what you're doing now?
At the moment, people with Lynch syndrome are diagnosed typically because when we diagnose someone with a cancer, we do some testing to see if there's the signature alteration that Lynch syndrome causes in the tumour, and then follow-on testing to test the DNA that they were born with. And that can tell us whether the person has Lynch syndrome or not. But, of course, that means that they've already been diagnosed with the cancer, so they have all the standard cancer treatments. So surgery to remove the cancer, possibly chemotherapy afterwards, and in proportion of cases that's all too high, by the time the cancer is diagnosed, it's already spread. What we need to do is to think about novel strategies to diagnose these people earlier and also, of course, to prevent cancer in people with Lynch syndrome. But we're exploring an alternative approach, which is that of vaccination.
I suppose the complexity here is, unlike someone who doesn't have Lynch syndrome and they do get a cancer, you treat that cancer, they can then regard themselves as in remission, let's say. But if someone has Lynch syndrome, the same mechanism that caused them to have the cancer in one part of their body or one part of their bowel, it could put all of their bowel at risk, so they're continually at risk. So having a way to keep the immune system on high alert has got to be the way forward.
Absolutely. So what we're working towards is targeting the power of the immune system to recognise, and we hope in the fullness of time, prevent cancer in people with Lynch syndrome. And in so doing, our hope is that that would work in all the tissues of the body, not just the bowel, but also in the womb and women who have Lynch syndrome and elsewhere.
Talk us through it then. How will this work? What do you actually do if you pick somebody up who's got it and you want to do this for them? What's involved?
We're analysing cancers and precancers in people with Lynch syndrome. So precancers are lumps, they're tumours, but they haven't actually had the alterations which mean that they're able to spread elsewhere in the body. So there's a period before a precancer becomes an actual cancer and has the risk of spreading and all the consequences that entails, of course. Now, I've already mentioned that people with Lynch syndrome have an error in copying their DNA, which means that the cells with this error accumulate errors or mutations. What this means is that those errors can cause abnormal proteins to be produced by the cells that carry this defect. And those abnormal proteins, we've known for some time, can be recognised by the immune system. So it's similar to if we get an infection. The body recognises that the infection isn't part of our normal body, and then the immune system can target the abnormal proteins, the proteins that the infection causes. And so it's the same with cancer. And the abnormal proteins that cancer makes can be recognised by the immune system. And we've known for some time, because cancers in people with Lynch syndrome have a large number of DNA errors or mutations, that they can be recognised by the immune system. But the immune response is ineffective. It's unable to control the cancer in these people. But what we're hoping to do is, by identifying these alterations in DNA and consequently in proteins, that we could actually anticipate the development of cancer, and by vaccinating against them, turbocharge or prepare the immune system to recognise these abnormal proteins so they can intercept the precancer before it becomes a cancer. So that's the ambition that we have.
Would it be different proteins or different constellations of proteins in each individual? So in other words, this is almost personalised medicine, in the respect that you go in and you've got to look and see which abnormal proteins this person's precancer might be making, and that's what then turn into your vaccine. Or have you got a one-size-fits-all strategy?
The latter. So there is a lot of interest in personalised vaccines, and there's a big initiative in the UK NHS to deliver personalised vaccines, including for bowel cancer. However, what we're talking about and thinking about here is an off-the-shelf approach. And what we know from the analysis that we and others have done is that cancers in Lynch syndrome have predictable alterations in their DNA. And that really raises the possibility that we could develop a one-size-fits-all vaccine.
David Church there. So although nearly half of us are destined to develop cancers in our lifetimes, our ability to stay one step ahead and manage the disease has arguably never been better. We're moving now towards an era when cancer might be regarded as a chronic disease that, a bit like high blood pressure, we can just control with drugs. And having heard what David, Debashis, Margaret and Charlie have told us this week, I, for one, now feel a lot more optimistic about the future. Next time, we're going to be examining the long-term legacy of the COVID-19 lockdowns. What did they do to us, society in general, the economy, and the way diseases circulate? If you'd like to join in the conversation, why don't you drop us a line? It's 5LiveScience@bbc.co.uk. In the meantime, from me, Chris Smith, and from all of us here at the Naked Scientist team, thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
And good morning, and from all of us at the Weekend Breakfast team, hello.
Hello, yes, all of us at the team.
Yes.
You're speaking on behalf. On behalf of myself and the driver and all of the team on board.
It's a lovely, lovely team we've got actually this morning as well. And it's great to have you with us. Welcome. Here till 10 o'clock with the breakfast programme.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And here are the headlines. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has described the killing of Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah as a historic turning point. Iran, which backs Hezbollah, has promised to avenge his death, stoking fears of escalation in the region. Dinah Strawl is from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Hezbollah has been Iran's insurance policy, and Hezbollah's arsenal of missiles, attack drones, and rockets is always what Iran planned to unleash on Israel when the regime in Tehran feels or has felt threatened. But now Israel has been so successful in decapitating the entire senior leadership of this organization and eliminating so many of its weapons that Iran has really lost that insurance policy.
The MP Rosie Duffield has accused Sir Keir Starmer's government of taking Labour voters for granted. She's resigned from the party and will now sit as an independent MP. She's criticised the Prime Minister for accepting tens of thousands of pounds worth of gifts from donors. Downing Street is yet to respond. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
Rosie Duffield told the BBC she believed Sir Keir Starmer cared more about greed and power than making a difference. Her resignation letter was deeply critical of the Prime Minister for his leadership, calling it uninspiring. His policy of cutting winter fuel support, saying it's cruel and unnecessary, and his accepting of gifts, calling it avarice off the scale. Speaking to Sunday with Laura Kunzberg, she said it was profoundly disappointing. There's no sign other Labour MPs plan to follow her. Reactions from them have ranged from regret she's gone to criticism that she had not already been suspended by the party.
The Conservative Party conference starts in Birmingham today. The four contenders for the leadership will make their pitches before Tory MPs decide which two will make it through to the final ballot.
Three people have been charged with murdering a man who was stabbed in Norwich last week. The body of Calvin Taylor, who was 19, was found in a flat last Saturday.
SpaceX has launched its mission to bring back two astronauts stranded on the International Space Station since June. The Dragon capsule, which has two empty seats for Butch Wilmore and Suni Williams, lifted off from Cape Canaveral.